Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for joining us. A sobering topic today, but one that can open to hope if enough of us take it seriously. We're talking this hour about the increase in suicides in the U.S. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention released new data last month. From 1999 to 2014, the U.S. suicide rate rose by about a quarter to 13 suicides per 100,000 people. Suicide rates increased for every age group under 75 years old. For middle-aged women aged 45 to 64, it rose by 63%. For men in that age range, suicides increased by 43% from a higher base. Men are still more likely to kill themselves. For one group in particular, the suicide rate tripled, girls between the ages of 10 and 14. For them, the rate rose from 0.5 to 1.7 suicides per 100,000 people. Overall, suicide is the 10th leading cause of death in the United States. Nearly 43,000 Americans took their own lives in 2014. Statistics from the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention reveal a startling portrait of suicide in America. On average, there are 117 suicides each day. White men account for 7 of 10 suicides in 2014. Firearms account for almost 50% of all suicides. In the face of this public health crisis, we are looking today at what is driving up suicide rates and what interventions can stop a person from taking their life. Joining me in Studio A are two experts in the field of suicide prevention and research. Jody Jacobson-Fry is an associate professor in the University of Maryland School of Social Work. She's the principal investigator on a study funded by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to evaluate an online screening tool that targets men ages 35 to 64, a group at higher risk for suicide. Welcome to Midday.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. And Holly Wilcox is an associate professor in the schools of medicine and public health at Johns Hopkins University. She studies the causes and prevention of suicidal behaviors and mood disorders among children and adolescents. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sheila. It's great to be here.
I'm glad you're with us. I'd like to get a sense from both of you, just overall, what do you think is behind this increase in suicide? Why is it happening? Jody Fry?
Well, I think it's very complex. So in the past, we have focused a lot of our research in suicide on youth and older adults. And now the trends in the most recent report are pointing out the increases in the past 15 years with middle-aged women and men. And I think when we focus on what's going on in middle age, it's a very complex stage where people are highly invested in work and family. And sometimes when perceptions about how that how losses may be happening with work or relationships can increase risk for suicide among middle-aged men and women. So I think in terms of risk factors of what's going on now, we certainly are concerned about long-term effects of a slow responding economy, issues of unemployment, poverty, as well as substance abuse and depression. All of these factors together, I think, are increasing risk for middle-aged adults and probably also other age groups where we're seeing increases.
Holly Wilcox, what are your thoughts about what fundamentally is going on with these numbers?
I agree with everything Jody said. The other thing to point out is that certain age groups are captured better within service systems that can deliver suicide prevention. So for example, schools is one arena where we can reach a large proportion of young people even prior to the point where they develop the serious risk factors for suicide. So efforts that they're somewhat captured in school. And so if we can deliver interventions to them while they're there, that hopefully can make an impact. Another example is among older adults. Oftentimes they see a primary care physician for physical ailments and conditions. And that's another window of opportunity, so to speak, to be able to identify depression and treat depression or suicide risk within that population. The middle age group is tricky because sometimes they are not captured in these different service sectors where we can deliver suicide prevention interventions. I mean, there is work and there are other settings, but there hasn't been as much suicide prevention focused on that age population.
Well, is the fact that the numbers are going up, and indeed went up somewhat faster after 2006, I believe, than during the early part of this period from 1999. Does the fact that the numbers are rising an indication that we're not taking advantage of those points of intervention?
Yes. I think we have to. There hasn't been the level of investment that we need to be successful. And that would
What kind of investment do you mean?
I mean a financial investment, a resource, and sort of responsibility. Folks, we work really from grants and contracts that last 2, 3, 4 years. And we go in and we go into sites and we do suicide prevention. And once the funding ends, oftentimes these programs aren't sustained. So what I think we need to do is we need to build suicide prevention into how we do business. In schools, we need to intervene in health education class, which is mandatory for students. We need to make our best effort to try to get information to them that could be useful for suicide prevention and for their own health in general.
Let me interrupt, because you're using the phrase suicide prevention I think many of us don't know what makes suicide prevention.
Yeah.
I mean, Jody Frey, let me turn to you and ask you to weigh in on that, too. I mean, what is it that could be done? Because I'm sure for many families, when it hits or when it even comes close, they feel at sea. They feel like, I don't know what I could have done.
I think in terms of prevention, so one of the grants you mentioned that I have is funded by the CDC, and of course I'm speaking on my own regard here, not to represent views of the CDC, but in thinking about suicide as a public health problem, I think it opens up some more potential opportunities to think about prevention and early intervention. So historically, suicide has been thought and treated as a mental health problem. So the interventions that we have and that have been tested have really been focused on individuals. And when we look at the numbers, some of what you mentioned affecting individuals that die by suicide each year, we also need to think about the ripple effects that has on family members, community, in the workplace where I do a lot of my research, on coworkers and colleagues, to address suicide and focus on preventing suicide with a multifaceted, comprehensive approach. And so what that means is to focus on, for example, preventing some of the risk factors from ever happening. Issues about unemployment, underemployment, financial and legal stressors, substance abuse, exposure to trauma, poverty. These are large, broad brush problems in society that couple together when someone has many of these risk factors places them at higher risk for suicide. Additionally, I think reducing stigma. So the fact that suicide is still underreported and not talked about is a major barrier to being able to do prevention work. Without talking about this, as Holly mentioned, the funding is lacking, the commitment to ongoing programs to figure out what works and then scale them up throughout the country is minimal. And part of that, I think, is the stigma that is still associated with suicide. People don't want to talk about this. I'll give you a quick example. Before I got into my research, I worked as an employee assistance professional. So in the workplace, doing counseling. And what interested me and focused me on suicide was that we were doing so much in the workplace about homicide and workplace violence and really not addressing increasing suicide problems. And whenever there was a suicide, the workplace was very quick to say that person had personal problems. That had nothing to do with work. Work shouldn't be involved. and therefore work wasn't involved in the response or earlier in the prevention.
Okay, but I need to jump in, and let me just remind listeners that that's Jody Jacobson Fry, an associate professor at the University of Maryland School of Social Work, here on Midday on WYPR, and also with me here in the studio is Holly Wilcox, an associate professor in the Schools of Medicine and Public Health at Johns Hopkins University. We're talking about the upsurge in suicides in the United States and what can be done about them. You made the point, Professor Fry, that there's a stigma associated with suicide. And I'm left thinking, shouldn't there be? If there's not a stigma, wouldn't we have even more people who turn to this as, I got a problem, maybe suicide is the way out?
Do we want society to accept
suicide?
No, and we need to also remember that most people go through developmental stages without considering or attempting suicide. But I think being able to talk about lived experience, for example, when someone has attempted suicide and lives, to tell about stories of hope and recovery. In my work with middle-aged men, the research that has been done to create an intervention that we're testing online called Man Therapy, we talked to men and said, what is it that you want? What will engage you in help-seeking behavior related to suicide? And one of the biggest things they wanted was to hear stories of hope and recovery.
Right, and we are going to do exactly that in the next part of this show. But I want to get your thoughts, Professor Wilcox, on stigma and how society ought to be looking both at the trend but at individuals.
It's a critically important question for sure. And what I think we need to do is we need to stigmatize the act of suicide in some respects, although it's not great for families who suffer a loss. But what we want to do is we want to try to reduce stigma for the conditions that lead up to suicide, like depression and substance abuse, and getting help for those conditions or for suicidality. We want to destigmatize that while we increase stigma in terms of the act of suicide.
That sounds like kind of a hat trick.
Yeah.
To pull that off.
Yeah, no, it is. I mean, and there's enough evidence to show that in certain communities where there's social taboo against stigma.
Social taboo against suicide or against stigma?
I'm sorry, social taboo against suicide, the rates are lower. But in communities with low social taboo, the rates are higher. So there's sort of community level differences in social factors and cultural factors related to suicide.
Professor Fry, gets back to what your point about looking at this both as a mental health issue, but also as a public health issue. I guess maybe one basic thing for us to understand is a mental health issue, is a mental illness involved in most suicides?
I think the statistics show that in 90% of deaths by suicide, there is a diagnosable mental health problem, and often depression that may be undiagnosed or misdiagnosed, undertreated. But most people that have a mental health condition do not consider or attempt suicide. And I think it's important to differentiate that. And what we look, there's some national data out there that looks at the decedents of suicide in death reporting. And what we're finding is that it's not just mental health problems. There's a lot of other factors that are going on a few weeks before someone dies by suicide. And one in particular that really stands out is interpersonal violence. In about 30% of all deaths by suicide in the National Violence Surveillance Data Reporting System, that covers about 60% of all violent deaths in the U.S., interpersonal violence and severe relationship problems was noted as an important factor leading up to the suicide death. So it's not always mental health problems. It's relationship problems. It's problems in society. It's issues of violence in general, as well as substance abuse and depression and mental health.
There's lots more I want to ask you about, which we will after we take this short break. And as you suggested, Professor Fry, we're going to focus on on a story of recovery. We'll hear from a woman who overcame thoughts of suicide and now works in the mental health field. You can be part of this conversation. Have you or a loved one been affected by suicide? What factors do you think contribute to this increasing rate of suicide? Join our conversation. Give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. New data from the federal government show that the suicide rate has risen over the past 15 years, increasing for every age group except older adults. Suicide is the 10th leading cause of death in the U.S. Nearly 43,000 Americans took their own lives in 2014. Here with me in the studio to talk about suicide and what can be done to reverse this alarming trend are two experts in the field, Jody Jacobson-Fry, an associate professor in the University of Maryland School of Social Work, and Holly Wilcox, an associate professor in the Schools of Medicine and Public Health at Johns Hopkins University. You can be part of this conversation. What can be done, in your view, to overcome the stigma of seeking treatment for mental health issues that sometimes underlay attempts at suicide? You can phone us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Holly Wilcox, we were talking about stigma, and I didn't really get a chance to follow up with you. There was a point you wanted to make.
One point I want to make is that we were talking about 90%. Some psychological autopsies after death show that when people go back to the families of folks who die by suicide, the research shows that around 90% of people who die have had some type of psychiatric disorder, at least one. And the other point that I think is worth mentioning, that there is the psychiatric risk we know is there for sure, but oftentimes there's an acute stressor that in combination with having a psychiatric condition like depression or substance abuse and so forth, the acute stressors such as humiliation, a relationship breakup, that can also increase risk for suicide. And that combination of having the psychiatric condition and also having this acute stressor sometimes can be seen as like a triggering event for someone to start thinking about suicide.
Seen in retrospect.
Yeah.
Is this something that families and teachers and folks can use to get ahead of somebody's plans for suicide?
Absolutely. That combination is known through decades of clinical work and research to be a one combination to look out for prospectively. And within that context, there's facilitating factors and inhibiting factors. And so within that context, one thing you would want to look out for is whether the person has access to lethal means, whether they have a loaded gun with easy access in their home and other access to lethal means, and do they have social support, and how can you build the social support around that person to get them through this crisis?
I'd love to offer a resource for listeners out there. I work with the American Association of Suicidology, and I train clinicians to recognize and respond to signs of suicide. And one of the acronyms available on their website, suicidology.org, is ISPATH WARM. And it's an easy acronym to really cover some of what Holly was just mentioning that looks for warning signs. So not the chronic stressors that people may have in their lives, but what goes on in the 24 to 48 hours before someone attempts to die by suicide. And that includes things like having significant ideation and changes in patterns of substance use, alcohol, drug use, feeling purposelessness, and increased anxiety and stress. So these triggering facts, is PATH warm, stands for each one of these. And I think that's something that families, teachers, and concerned loved ones can look at and be aware of, so they'll know if someone is at risk for suicide and these are going on, that we really need to start asking some questions directly.
And the place to get that list is at suicidology.org. So that's suicidology.org.
Yes.
We will link to that from...
And they also, when you go on that list, have a new link for a similar warning signs acronym for youth and adolescents.
Okay. You used a word that I hear used only in relation to suicide. Can one of you give me a very quick definition of ideation?
Ideation usually means thoughts about suicide and wanting to die.
Okay. So when you say that there's an increase in ideation in the 24 hours ahead of suicide, it's an increase in people thinking about it.
Yes.
Okay.
And then I think taking it further, Sheila, also, if someone has ideation, to start asking about, does that person have a plan? And have they maybe thought about the behaviors that they would take to act out that plan? And then also, as Holly mentioned, do they have the means? Is there a gun? Is there access to medication at a lethal dose?
Right. I want to ask you more about that, but I want to pull Denise Valentine into our conversation. She is a program specialist for NAMI Maryland. NAMI is the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Before that, she served as education director for NAMI Baltimore, and she joins us by phone. Thanks for joining us, Denise.
Hello.
So, Denise, I understand that you yourself came very close to suicide once.
Yes, I did. I, almost 20 years ago, I had planned on committing suicide. I had picked out my method, which was to take, I had saved up all of my psychiatric medications for a month, and I had picked out the day, and that particular day, I was going to do it when I got home from being out and about, and while I was out, I saw the NAMI sign. And
a sign on an office building?
A sign outside the office building, and it was just a coincidence, and I decided to get out and to go in to the NAMI offices, and I went into the offices, and prior to this, I had been homeless and had been out and about and had seen that sign but never had gone in. I had been homeless for several years, and had also been hospitalized as a result of that homelessness for a couple of years. So,
and Denise, let me interrupt before you tell us what happened when you walked into that NAMI office, that the National Alliance on Mental Illness office. What kind of thoughts were you having? What was going on with you that you had picked out a date and organized a way to commit suicide?
What was going on with me was I was reflecting on my life. Prior to having been homeless and hospitalized, I had been a senior auditor for the Department of Defense Inspector General's office. And as a result of a psychiatric illness, I had quit that job, and I had lost custody of my children and become homeless. And I was reflecting on my life, and I felt that it was purposeless. I felt like I was a failure, that I had a life that wasn't worthy of living. And I was in a deep, deep clinical depression. And I had psychotic features, so I was also hearing voices. Although the voices weren't actively telling me to commit suicide, that was just another stressor. So that's what was going on with me at the time that I had decided to commit suicide.
And so by chance, you saw a sign for the NAMI office that you'd seen before, but this time you went in, and what happened?
Well, when I went in, I met the executive director met me, and she was a very busy lady. I could tell because she had piles of papers on the desk, and she pushed them aside, and She took out some leaflets and some information, and she told me about some of the services that NAMI offers. And as a result of that, I decided to go to a support group meeting, which was meeting that Saturday morning. So that night I went home, and I sat all night with the pills in front of me and a glass of water, and I stared at them all night, and I kept saying to myself, well, you can wait one more day. What difference does one more day make? You can try going to the meeting and see, just try it and see what happens. And I went to that meeting, and there was a whole crowd of people just like me, and I was amazed. You know, I was amazed that I was not alone, that there were other people that suffered in the same way that I suffered, and it appeared to be getting some relief. So at the end of that meeting, I went home, and for the whole week before the next meeting, I contemplated suicide, but I said, well, let's hold on for another meeting. And that went on for about a month, and gradually the thoughts of suicide lessened, and I was able to resume my therapy and become a more active participant in my therapy, which provided more relief.
So it was not a quick turnaround.
It wasn't a quick turnaround, but when you think of someone that really actively is planning on committing suicide, has picked out the time, the method, and everything, to be able to provide a person with enough psychological relief where they don't feel like it's necessary to do it right that moment is big.
Yeah, it's literally life and death. It's big.
It's big because I have been diagnosed with recurrent major depression with psychotic features and post-traumatic stress disorder. And both of those illnesses are serious mental illnesses, and they can result in death. And for me, that would have happened had I not received the peer support that was necessary to supplement my psychiatric care.
This is Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Denise Valentine, who overcame thoughts of suicide and now works in the mental health field. Also with me in the studio are two experts who study suicide, Holly Wilcox of the Schools of Public Health and Medicine at Johns Hopkins University and Jody Jacobson-Fry of the University of Maryland School of Social Work. You can be part of this conversation also if you call us at 410-662-8780 or send an email to us at midday@wypr.org. Let me ask either of you here in the studio, when you hear Denise describe how close she came, is that something that you've seen?
Well, I just want to first, Denise, this is Jody. I just want to thank you for sharing your story. I think that it takes a lot of courage to come forward mm-hmm. with stories about suicide and mental health and mental illness. But it's so important that people hear these stories of recovery and hope that I was mentioning before the break. I think this is very common, actually. And when you asked earlier, Sheila, what is suicide prevention? And so from a public health perspective, having messages in the community, meeting people where they are, when they need the help, is really critical. The study that I'm about to start in Michigan is focused on online campaigns for men. Men are online. How can we reach them in their homes, in their communities, to have an opportunity to give them a message of hope that there is something out there, whether it be peer support or counseling or psychosocial supports or medication. There are treatments that work. And I think we need to have opportunities and messaging so that people will think there'll be an interruption of a suicide plan, like what Denise was talking about. She saw that poster and she had seen it before, but it was the timing of when she saw that and what was going on in her thoughts and in her plans that made a difference that time around. Thank goodness it was there for her to see, and that opportunity for her to connect with peers that had other lived experiences.
Denise, I am so grateful to you for sharing all this. I understand that you have a plan in place to make sure that you don't get to that point again. Tell us about that plan.
Well, one of the things that NAMI offers is a peer-to-peer recovery education course. It's the relapse prevention class, and I've taken that class, and I'm also taking the RAP class, which is a wellness and recovery action plan. So between those two classes, I've developed a relapse prevention plan. And that particular plan is where I've identified triggers, things that cause me to feel that way. And I have identified coping skills and coping mechanisms that I can put into place that will help me to overcome those feelings.
Can you give me an example of a coping skill that works?
Well, one thing that works for me is to make sure that I keep in contact with my peer support, my peer network. When I get those feelings, I talk with someone in addition to talking to my therapist. I talk to someone who's been there. And sometimes I talk to my therapist, and they recommend that it's time for me to contact my therapist.
So sometimes it's something that you yourself are not seeing.
And when it's something that I'm not seeing, I also have people in my support network that can point out to me that it is time, you know, don't you think it's time for you to call your doctor? Or if it goes further than that, I've also given my my daughter and my mother my permission, and I put quotation marks around that, to emergency petition me if it becomes necessary.
Wow.
And so those things, I pulled my family in on my recovery plan. I pulled my friends in, and along with my therapist and my psychiatrist. So those are some of the things I put into place to help subvert the suicidal ideations.
Denise Valentine, we need to take a quick break. Can you stay with us for a few more minutes?
Mm-hmm.
Great. We, as I said, are going to take a quick break here. We're going to continue to talk about suicide, how to approach it, how to head it off. You can be part of this conversation. You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org, or you can phone us at 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. If you're just joining us, we're talking today about some disturbing statistics, federal data that shows that suicide rates have risen by more than a quarter since 1999 in this country. I'm speaking with Jody Jacobson-Fry, Associate Professor in the University of Maryland School of Social Work, and Holly Wilcox, Associate Professor in the Schools of Medicine and Public Health at Johns Hopkins University, and Denise Valentine, a woman who came very close to suicide and now works with NAMI, the National Association on Mental Illness here in Maryland. Denise, I wanted to ask you, well, tell me more about what is it that you do with NAMI?
NAMI Maryland. NAMI Maryland provides training and for facilitators, teachers, and mentors for the local affiliates in Maryland. And it also does advocacy work.
And so you are a program specialist, which I'm sure puts you in the middle of that. But
yes. The programs, I help coordinate the trainings for the programs at NAMI Maryland. And the programs are education and support programs for family members and individuals living with mental illness.
Denise, if someone listening to this program is considering seeking help, they're not quite sure, what would you tell them?
Well, one of the things that prevented me from seeking help was stigma, self-blame, and shame that surrounding having a mental illness. And I would tell them that they're not alone, and they're not alone in those feelings, but to actively seek help will help lessen those feelings and the feelings of shame and stigma.
Sound advice. I really do. I'm very, very grateful to you, Denise, for speaking with us. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you very, very much. One of the things that I think we learned from Denise was how proactive she is in involving what she called her support group, including her family, and saying, let me know when I need to step up my recovery plan. Let me do something. I think many of us think we'd be walking on eggshells around someone if we think they are thinking of suicide, if we talk about it, that will put the idea in their head. So what do you experts say about that? Is it a smart thing to ask somebody in your family if they're thinking of suicide?
Yes, it's important to ask directly. Oftentimes a family member will suspect and will say, you're not suicidal, are you? You know, and that's not the way to ask, but more, you know, ask directly, are you having thoughts of suicide? And oftentimes...
Do you lead up to that question, or can you just ask that question?
You can lead up, whatever's comfortable for you in asking. You can do a lead up or not. But it's important to ask directly. In that way. And people are concerned that, you know, by asking, you're going to give someone ideas or plant the idea. And there's enough evidence to show that that's not the case. But rather, just by asking, you open the door for that person to come forward to get the help they need.
I that's exactly right, Holly. I think in terms of research that's interviewed, survivors of suicide attempts have found that by someone asking directly opened that door. They're feeling so isolated and alone and stigmatized, some of what Denise was telling us already, that to be asked a question, you're not thinking that, are you, is further shaming them because they are thinking about
suicide.
So
that pushes them back. That doesn't open the door.
It closes the door even tighter. And unfortunately, we see this also with therapists, with doctors, people that are well-meaning, but really need to practice being able to ask direct questions. Are you having thoughts of killing yourself? I'm concerned about you. You can tell me if you are, and we can talk about that. It's a safe place to talk about what you're thinking. And then to have the knowledge to make referrals to someplace like NAMI or to the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. Connect someone who's in need of support with an expert who can do a more formal assessment and connect them with ongoing support resources.
NAMI's website, by the way, in Maryland is NAMIMD, NAMIMaryland.org. And their phone number, and we'll put these on our website, their phone number is 410-884-8691. 410-884-8691. Jason has called us from Baltimore. Jason, welcome to Midday.
Thank you. I wanted to just basically talk. I tried to take my own life in 2012, actually. And after that, as I kind of got put on the road to recovery and started taking my therapy more seriously, one of the main things that I realized that makes it very difficult for the average person to maybe show more sympathy to someone with depression is that it's very difficult for someone who's never experienced depression before to understand what it feels like. It's like trying to explain what it's like to break your arm to someone who's never broken any body. Like, you know, you've felt pain before, but it's a different level and it's a different type. And so a lot of times we hear, you know, people that are well-meaning talking to us, trying to help us feel better, but they end up basically just saying, well, stop being sad. I don't see what the problem is. Just stop being depressed.
So since you've been there, what can you tell those of us who haven't experienced depression about what we can do? Because there are people who care a great deal mm-hmm. for someone who's going through this, but apparently aren't saying the right things or making the right moves.
Not having the frame of reference to understand what depression is like is not a bad thing. You know, we don't think less of someone because they've never broken a bone, but it's accepting that you probably don't fully understand what it's like to be depressed, but believing the person who's talking to you when they tell you how miserable their life feels. And a lot of times it can literally just being patient with someone and letting them talk about how miserable their life feels without you trying to tell them, well, why don't you just feel happy instead? It's kind of just, you know, accepting that you're not any less of a person for not understanding what it feels like to be really, really depressed. But the other person could really use just listening without judging.
Listening without judging. Jason, I really appreciate your calling us. Do either of you want to respond to Jason?
Jason, thank you also for sharing your story and also what has been helpful or not helpful as you have reached out for support from different people. I think being able to talk openly about psychological pain, which is what people often talk about experiencing and feeling, that suicide seems like the only way out, that we need to be comfortable hearing that. Whether or not we've had depression or suicide ourselves, the person in front of us who is reaching out for help by bringing this topic up sees suicide as a logical response. And I think we do have to sit with that person and listen and then work together to try to come up with some other coping mechanisms that may be alternatives to suicide.
Well, as I listen to what Jason told us, I'm thinking, I mean, Jason said, listen, don't judge. But someone you love is saying, I'm thinking of suicide. Your instinct is to talk them out of it, to say, that's a stupid idea. Don't do that. I mean, how can someone who hasn't been there, as Jason laid out for us, how can someone who hasn't been there be smart about not judging but not worrying about encouraging it?
I think Jason's point was really great about the idea of just listening and then figuring out, you know, if you can, if that person needs to be linked with services. You know, it's fine to listen, but oftentimes you can determine if that person may need to see a trained professional and, you know, trying to serve as a bridge to get that person linked up with services if they need to get help.
So you can be pretty sure that you yourself don't have to be the one persuading them, that it's okay just to listen as long as you're connecting them to the next step.
And it's okay to say, you know, I don't have expertise in this area. I can listen and I can provide support, but maybe the right course of action would be for you to see a professional.
Andrew is calling us from Baltimore. Andrew, welcome to Midday.
Hi, thank you.
You're on the air.
Andrew? Hi, yes.
And your point?
Thank you for the great topic. I just became a nurse in December. I work at the Johns Hopkins Hospital in an inpatient unit in psychiatry, and I immediately saw the impacts of stigma on people's outcomes. And I noticed a lot of people don't want to take their medication or get treatment or talk about their psychiatric illnesses such as depression and its worst form, suicide, because of stigma. And I often tell a lot of my patients, you know, diabetes, heart disease, some of the most common diseases in America, people openly talk about, I'm on a weight loss plan, I'm on a diet, I have to watch my sugar. And, you know, the etiology, although it's different in the pathophysiology, in mental illness, the evidence shows is is a, you know, a chemical problem, anatomical problem in our brain. And a lot of my patients really respond well when we tell them, you know, you take your diabetes medicine, why don't you take your antidepressants or whatever it may be that works for that person, go to your therapy.
Gotcha. Thank you, Andrew, for making that point. Holly Wilcox, some people are probably shocked to hear that children as young as 10 or 11 have ideas about committing suicide or actually commit suicide. How does their thought process differ from adults who are contemplating suicide?
Mm. Young people tend to be more impulsive. They're in a developmental time where their brain is still developing. It continues to develop up till age 26. And so young people tend to be more quick from thought to action. And there are definitely differences in decision making. Another thing about adolescence and late childhood is that many of our psychiatric disorders that we've talked about today, depression, substance abuse, anxiety, have their origins in childhood and adolescence. And so the first symptoms start. So in some respects, during this time of impulsivity, there could be also introduced into that mix some symptoms that are scary for individuals, young people and their families to experience. Young people also tend to be more easily influenced by others' opinions. And they're also in a circumstance where they're living within a family, so they rely on their family to help them and to get the help they need if they do need it.
So it falls a lot, as it should, on parents. Mm-hmm. What advice can you give them if they think they're seeing something, or what kind of resource would you suggest a parent turn to?
Parents are critically important gatekeepers for their kids' care, and I think the main point to them, if they're concerned, trust their gut, and get help. Reach out to a professional. There are some situations families can handle on their own, and they can manage on their own. But if they feel that they can't, then the next step would be to speak with a mental health professional and get help, get an assessment.
This hour has flown by, and Jody Jacobson, for I didn't actually get a chance to talk to you about man therapy in detail. We should talk about it sometime. Can you give us just a short idea of what man therapy does?
Sure. Man therapy is one of the interventions I'm studying for middle-aged men. It was developed in Colorado with the Carson J. Spencer Foundation, CACTUS, and the Office of Suicide Prevention. They did research on what men that they like to call double jeopardy men that are at highest risk for suicide and hardest to engage in services. What do they want? And the result was online interventions that foster social support, reduce social isolation, and provide education about suicide and mental health in a humorous way, which was not easy to develop when you're talking about a topic of suicide.
Yeah.
So mantherapy.org is available throughout the U.S. and now has expanded to Australia. It's been used by hundreds of thousands of men in both rural and urban areas in this age group at highest risk, middle-aged men, to try to educate them that taking care of their mental health is a manly thing to do. So I encourage you all to take a look at it.
Mantherapy.org.
Yes.
We'll link to that also. I'm grateful to you both. Lots more to talk about. I hope we have another chance to do it. Jody Jacobson-Fry, Associate Professor in the University of Maryland School of Social Work. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Holly Wilcox, Associate Professor in the Schools of Medicine and Public Health at Johns Hopkins University. Thanks.
Thank you.
And earlier we spoke with Denise Valentine, Program Specialist for the Maryland Chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, Maryland. If you're looking for help, the Maryland Crisis Hotline is 1-800-422-0009, 800-422-0009. I want to thank Eddie's of Roland Park for providing lunch for our guest today. Eddie's is a full-service market with locations on North Charles Street, Roland Avenue. Eddie'sofRolandPark.com is their website. And thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow. Character, grit, determination. These are some of the qualities employers want their workers to have. How can teachers help instill them?
I'm Sheila Kast.